We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. This is episode one, Orientation. Thanks for joining us at Potterversity. Today, Emily Strand and I will talk about the latest in Harry Potter scholarship from the Harry Potter Academic Conference from Chestnut Hill College, and we'll talk about what you can expect from your Potterversity experience. I am Katie McDaniel, Professor of History at Marietta College and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2.
And I am Emily Strand, Instructor of Comparative Religions at Mount Carmel College, and contributor to Harry Potter for Nerds 2 and other scholarly collections on Potter.
Today is orientation. You know, Emily, I feel a little like I'm wandering in the wilderness with the strange times that we're living in. You feel like you're in like that part of book 7
or just I do. I get that vibe quite a lot. Although I love the fact that the podcasting can just kind of go on.
You know,
the podcasting is one of those things that never gets interrupted by global pandemics.
Well,
it's meant for social distancing.
Yeah. And, you know, I was thinking about it because, you know, they're wandering and there's this feeling of peril hovering over them as they wander. And this, too, I feel like I identify with. Maybe some others do, too. And so I like the hopefulness of calling our first Potterversity episode Orientation.
I need some orientation.
Exactly how I feel. I need a little orienting. And the podcast in the Harry Potter world, I think, is good at keeping us oriented and reminding us of what we're all about. I have that some of the little jitters in the stomach first day feelings.
Oh, yeah.
That I associate also with a good orientation.
I spent a lot of time picking out my outfit.
That's right. And of course, we're going to try to give our listeners a sense of what they can expect from the Potterversity education. So that is what we're all about, listeners, on this episode. We're going to try to give you a little sense of, you know, what the Potterversity experience is going to be like. What's interesting is when we made the switch to having to go to virtual learning during the pandemic, I had a lot of friends and colleagues, you probably this way too, Emily, who were like, I don't know how to like deliver content in a virtual format. And I thought, well, I have, you know, I have a podcasting microphone. So
right. It all of a sudden became quite the calling card, right?
Yeah.
And you're like sitting there with this microphone and people are like, wow, did
yeah.
you just order that? I'm like, no, I've had it for 10 years.
And I, you know, I had students asking like, how come your lectures sound so good? Well, you know, I have some equipment because I do this podcast. And I think that, you know, we are getting increasingly used to getting our education in virtual ways. I think podcasts are a major way that people who even aren't in school anymore continue to educate themselves about topics that are interesting to them. And certainly with schools, a lot of schools going to remote learning, we're seeing a lot more of this kind of thing.
Yes, indeed. It's like back to your metaphor about being in book 7 and wandering. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like our tent. It's like the place that we can kind of go back to and feel at home, even in this strange environment.
I love that. Very good. Very good. You know, I had sort of been thinking about Potter Watch, the radio show that kind of keeps them plugged in and thinking about the world at large. And, you know, our podcast is certainly a virtual way of experiencing education, but this year, the Harry Potter Academic Conference was also done virtually. And this was really exciting because it allowed scholars from a wide variety of places from around the world. What was it? Turkey and France Australia. We had lots of people from all over who were able to come to the conference and participate. And I just think that it opened up lots of interesting possibilities because it was in the virtual realm. And I thought it would be very fitting for our first episode of Potterversity for us to talk a little bit about the virtual education that we got at the Harry Potter Academic Conference and to talk about what you and I contributed, because we're Potter scholars and we'll kind of give our credentials to the listeners here on episode number one. So, Emily, what were the highlights of the conference for you?
I think I have to mention Brent Satterley's talk first, because I was deeply anticipating his talk. Let's see. The title of his talk was "I Take Umbrage with J.K. Rowling, LGBTQ Betrayal." And so I had anticipated his talk for a couple of weeks before the conference because it just sounded like it was going to be deeply satisfying. And I know Brent from previous conferences, as we all do. He's just a delightful human being.
And a marvelous speaker. Really wonderful speaker.
A performer. And to be honest, you know, I think a performer who is a teacher has a particular insight on how to connect with people, you know, because it's not just about the content. It's about that human connection. And Brent just does that so well. I mean, he's a social worker as well, right? So he just does that really, really well. And I thought that the way that he used humor to truth tell was particularly powerful and particularly effective and particularly important in the times that we live in. And so I really enjoyed Brent's talk, probably first and foremost. But I went to some really, really great other talks. I thought the entire session on psychology was extremely well done. They had a few technological blips at the beginning, but that session was extremely well done and well moderated. Louise Freeman's talk was part of that. Beth Sutton Ramspeck's talk was part of that. Fascinating. Yeah. Talk on the Sorting Hat. So I think that those talks were all just really had my brain all fired up.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's really interesting when you see people from a variety of disciplinary perspectives who are weighing in. And you talked about Brent Satterley's presentation. And, you know, as a social worker, I think the first time that I saw him talk at Chestnut Hill, he was talking about how he had used Harry Potter in his social work class. And that has, I think, led to him doing these very interesting, I would say, morally resonant talks, where he often has a refrain. And the refrain from, I think, one of his earlier talks was Expecto Patronum. Do you remember that one, Emily?
Yes, I do.
And the idea of, you know, we're this Expecto Patronum, this is a way we can actually defend each other and protect each other. And it's such a powerful metaphor. And in this talk, where he was channeling Dolores Umbridge, the refrain that he used was hem hem, the little throat clearing. Yes. And I just thought he did a beautiful job of showing how that precedes what are these really kind of passive aggressive slams on people. And that's the kind of thing that marginalized people often hear from people who are in privileged positions. The little, you know, hem hem, all lives matter.
And I'm not racist, but
right. And it just, again, I totally agree with you. Wonderful use of humor with something that was very poignant, emotionally resonant, and deeply moral, I think. And so then when you've got somebody in social work, Beth Sutton Ramspeck is a literature professor who looks at 19th century literature, she's Victorian literature, and she has been looking at, she's interested in house elves, but she's been looking at rule breaking, and she talked about it as creative maladjustment, the Martin Luther King Jr. phrase. You know, when I think about John Lewis's idea of good trouble.
I thought of that all throughout her talk.
Yeah. And that also seemed to me similarly just very apt timing, you know, very current in the same way that Brent Satterley's was. I also
and yet
really
in a totally different style.
Totally. Oh, yes, absolutely. Totally different style. On a similar kind of, I would say, very current note, I saw Lori Kim talking about the Korean actress Claudia Kim, who plays Nagini in Fantastic Beasts, and sort of trying to sort out some of the criticism that came from the casting there and her kind of understanding of Korean actresses. And it was just a wonderful reading of the film. Lori Kim always does such beautiful readings of texts. And here she did a beautiful reading of the film that honestly came time for questions. I was supposed to moderate and ask the questions. And I like had to pull myself together, Emily. It was.
I seem to remember that. But it was a move. It was a moving talk. And I agree that. You know, the reading that she did, as you said, the very deep reading of the film really contradicted so much of the criticism and the negative hype surrounding the casting of this woman, this Korean woman as Nagini, and really showed the strength of her character. Although, I mean, she was kind of a minor character, you know, I didn't pay her maybe enough attention when I watched the film, but it made me, I mean, the best thing I can say about it, it made me want to go back and rewatch the film to appreciate what Lori saw when she did her reading.
Right. And, you know, she actually used deleted scenes as a part of her analysis, which I think is an interesting, you know, it's an interesting dilemma. And to think about why was it deleted and then what can you still get from it? And I just thought that was, it was just very interesting to see how she was, you know, pulling in these scenes that otherwise they might have given us more shape to that character if they had been left in.
You're speaking a Star Wars fan's language right now. Deleted scenes. We love the deleted scenes.
Right, right. Absolutely.
So much meaning. Changes everything.
Yeah. Maybe. Now, we also had some folks who were guests on Reading, Writing, Rolling, Lana Whited and Louise Freeman, who delivered talks on subjects that they had come on our podcast to actually talk about.
That was exciting.
Yeah.
That was so
exciting. Lana really fleshed out the reasons why you should read Hogwarts: A History, which was really interesting. It's sort of like all the things that we know about Matilda Bagshot. And do we know that she wrote Hogwarts: A History?
Right.
Which is sort of an interesting ambiguity about that.
And we should say that these were folks who were on our previous podcast.
Right.
It's this continuity. It feels so natural. But you know, they were on Reading, Writing, Rolling. Yeah.
Yeah. And Louise Freeman was on our humor episode. And she did wonderful psychological analysis of what the humor in the books is doing and how it is acting on the reader and sort of informing us at the same time. And it was funny and analytical at the same time, which is classic Louise.
Is classic Louise. I was just going to say that's classic Louise. That's why I like hanging out with Louise, is because she, and it was funny because, you know, just to bring up these humorous moments, but then to analyze them and look at what they're doing, it doesn't evacuate them of humor at all. In fact, if anything, it makes it more funny, you know, to me.
Yeah.
To think about how this is operating and think about the work that it's doing, you know, as it's making you laugh.
Yeah, I know. That's the classic nerd thing, because as nerds, knowing the analytical part just adds to the fun and the funny.
Right, it does. It does.
Yeah, yeah. And on the panel that I was on in the morning on Friday, Jeff Ambrose was on there. And Jeff Ambrose, he's given some talks at Harry Potter Academic Conference before. Always very interesting. And he did a deep reading of the scene where Mad-Eye Moody is teaching the students the Imperius Curse. And of course, it's actually Barty Crouch Jr. in disguise. But he looked at it as pedagogy. And he says, you see all these people talking about education in the Harry Potter novels. And he says, people really leave out this particular very important lesson that actually is quite successful with the students, and you know, who become the DA. They're learning about the unforgivable curses. And that is such a very important experience for all of them that then informs a lot of the rest of the things that they do for the whole rest of the series.
Why do we think that people leave that out when they talk about pedagogy? Is it because they're learning something that a lot of people don't think they ought to be learning by somebody who's not actually supposed to be their teacher?
Yes, and if you look at, I mean, I think about the way that it's portrayed in the films, especially, you wouldn't like automatically say teacher of the year for Mad-Eye Moody. You know what I mean?
Neville's pretty much traumatized.
Right.
And he's not the only one.
Yeah, and he seems kind of singled out. And, let's remember, it's really a Death Eater teaching them this stuff. So it's maybe, it's done with a
Right.
sort of a, it's done in a way that's kind of harsh, but there's an effectiveness to it. Yeah, I think it's really interesting. And I do think that there's maybe a problem with the fact that is it Mad-Eye Moody? Is it Barty Crouch Jr.? And I think that makes people uneasy about talking about who's really teaching that lesson.
And can we just, while we're on this topic, can we just call out Patrick McCauley and Karen Wendling,
Oh,
because
absolutely.
they did such a good job, and the com you know they do work with a committee of folks who helped to select the papers and everything. Because every time I see a paper listed on the schedule of the conference, and this is, I think I've been going, what, 7 years, 6 years now or something like that. And every time I see a talk, when I think, well, I think I've already heard a similar talk like that before, then if I end up going anyway, it is actually a new take. It's a totally different take on it than I would have expected. So, and I have to just credit the folks who are selecting the papers, to come into the conference and really, helping it be something that's really enriching for even those, folks who go every year. Still, you
Absolutely.
still hear something new, something different, something inspiring.
I totally agree with that. I totally agree with that. And I mean, I heard stuff that was jaw-dropping. Do you remember Barbara Purdom, who talked about
Yes.
Guy Fawkes
Oh.
and the gunpowder plot?
I
And
can't wait to listen to it again because there
yeah.
was so much.
Yes, I mean it was a wonderful presentation, and she sort of thinks about Hogwarts as a sort of separate church from the ministry
Yes.
in Book Five, The Order of the Phoenix. She calls it the Order of the Gunpowder Plot,
Mm-hmm.
and she's unfolding all of these different layers of rivalry and suspicion and the actions taken against each other and institutional power and all of that. Fascinating, really fascinating talk that she gave. And she gave another one on Red Riding Hood, but I didn't get a chance to see that one.
And those are, a lot of these folks are posting their talks, because they all the talks were pre-recorded. Most of the talks were pre-recorded. So a lot of folks have been posting their talks on their various websites or YouTube channels and everything. So you can do some Googling to find out.
Absolutely. That's whoa. Yeah. You're reminding me, maybe I can do that to come up with some of these. There was Valerie Estelle Frankel, who she presented a couple of talks as well, and she's written a whole lot of books, and I thought, well, she's somebody I need to read more of her stuff. So I thought there were a lot of good ones. I one of the ones that's really stuck with me is Chris Bell,
Yes.
and he has this really interesting reading of Harry, where he says, maybe Harry is biracial. And what if we think about if James Potter, maybe he's Afro-British and Harry is biracial. And then how does that make us understand some of the other relationships and the course he takes in his schooling? If he's coming in as somebody who is, straddling two worlds, and when people look at him, they are seeing somebody who straddles two worlds, and that's why his mother's eyes seem to be so striking in his face when other people see them. It was one of those ones where you think I could read the whole series of novels a little bit differently, thinking from this perspective. Really fascinating.
Because those realities are there in the text because of the issues of blood purity and the emphasis on magic, with regard to running in families and showing up, it sometimes spontaneously in Muggle families. So you have that dynamic in the plot already. So it's really not too many steps further to take it into a more literal arena of race, and to imagine the story that way too. I feel like it's just another helpful way for us to relate to it in a new way, in a meaningful way.
Yeah, and I agree. Like I tend to resist things that I think are an imposition on the text. But I thought that actually you could see that it sort of starts to rise up from the text once you start to look at it that way. And that's what I thought made it a particularly good perspective.
Yeah, agree. Agree.
Yeah. And of course, we have many friends of the show who were presenting. So our producer, Lori Beckhoff, did a really interesting thing, had a paper, One Last Time, Liminality and Role Reversal in King's Cross and the Book of Merlin. The Book of Merlin is the kind of the sequel to The Once and Future King
Right, by
and
T.H. White.
by T.H. White. And but it's one that people don't usually read. And she finds some really surprising parallels between that and the kind of conversation that Harry has with Dumbledore in King's Cross. So I thought that was really fascinating. Also, Lauren Camacci did a pretty close reading. I like all these close readings of scenes that people are doing. She was looking at the friendship, platonic friendship between Harry and Ron, and how that's portrayed in the books, particularly in the scene after Ron destroys the Horcrux, right? Pulls Harry out, saves his life, destroys the Horcrux. You know, the very real and physical demonstration of affection between the two friends in the book, and then the way that it's portrayed in the movie, where they could not be farther apart.
Right.
And then she
Poor
actually even
Ron.
looks at the Lego version that's even worse. I think it's a video game, maybe a Lego video game
Yeah.
version.
Yeah.
I thought that was also very interesting, very interesting.
And I anytime I feel like you can bring in Legos to an academic paper, you're winning. You're winning academia.
The conference, there's so much good stuff. I just feel
Yeah.
like I never know what kind of wonderful gems I'm going to get. And you know, Patrick McCauley had a paper where he was also talking about platonic friendship, particularly between Harry and Hermione. And I just think he's so good talking about that. And that's something that, I mean, I think it's something in our culture. We're suspicious of things, of relationships that are genuinely platonic. And I
Right.
really like that he's focusing on why is it important that Harry and Hermione do not end up together. I'm not a Harry and Hermione shipper.
No, nor am
Not at
I.
all. Okay, good. We can be friends still.
Good.
But I know that a lot of people do want them to be together, and I think there's something really to be said for wonderful platonic relationships. And so I'm really glad to see some of that coming through in both Lauren and Patrick's papers.
Yes, those are two, and also Laurie's. I missed. That is the hard thing about this conference, is that you do have to pick being in a place. So,
Right.
and
Even
Laurie's was opposite mine.
virtually, even virtually, you can
Even
only be
virtually,
one room at a time.
that's true. I'm kind of hoping that maybe they'll open up the conference content to us again, so we can kind of go through. And I don't know if they have the platform to be able to do that. I've been to other virtual conferences where that's the case, but you know, that would be like my little wish list. That would be on my wish list, that we could kind of
Yeah.
crack it open and go back to certain talks. But I am looking forward to going and checking out those that have been posted.
Right. And I think we have to say a little bit also about Timothy Snyder's keynote, which was about in his little book on tyranny, where he sort of describes the process by which totalitarian regimes begin to take over and then how it's possible to resist those. And he really connected that to the books. He had mentioned that the Harry Potter books actually do a good job of that. And in this talk, he was just much more specific about it. And he approached that as somebody who doesn't do Harry Potter scholarship. He's actually a historian of 20th century Eastern Europe, and he's read the Harry Potter novels. And so he was really just putting it together. And it was really wonderful and different. I think it had some different perspective, partly because he is not in the Harry Potter scholarship realm, and I thought it was very relevant.
I agree. And I also picked up some new insights on the immortality quest aspect of the narrative that I found really interesting. And our listeners might hear a little bit more about that later in this episode.
Yes, I know that was a controversial idea. That the reason we do good things is because we recognize our mortality. What do we think about that? Is that really what's going on? All right, so okay, so we'll stay tuned for that. You know, one of the things that was, you know, it's a shame in the virtual realm we can't see each other in person. You don't get those little talks afterward, where you're just kind of hanging out in the, in the foyer and you're, or you see somebody, oh, hey, I really liked your talk, and you get a chance to talk with them. But I thought that amazingly in the chat, there was just a lot of fun back and forth with people that I really enjoyed. So I did think I got a little of my, Harry Potter social time, which I wasn't expecting. It was actually pretty interactive, I thought.
Yeah, it was. It was. And I enjoyed being able to sort of connect with people during the talks and sort of react in real time to some of my favorites, you included. And to be able to do that and kind of say, okay, where are you going next? And where, here's where I'm going to go, and I'll see you over there, even though, we weren't really seeing each other, but
Right.
it was still had a kind of collegial feel.
Yes, very collegial. And I think this, our Potter Studies community is definitely, we have a vibe and it is so wonderfully positive. I would say we definitely, are challenging of each other and, we are definitely, we know a lot and we definitely ask good hard questions. But at the same time, I think there is an air of support and fun that I really love about that collegial Potter Studies community that's developing.
It's magical.
Magical. So,
Yeah.
Emily, you presented on my favorite topic, food in Harry Potter, and particularly how food imagery and feasting and fasting in the book series reflect the Eucharist. Where did you get the idea for this paper?
Well, that the Eucharist is my sort of main focus of study, academically and pastorally too. I mean, I'm somebody who is a hands-on liturgist. I don't just study it, I do it as well. And I had written about Dobby's burial as a foot washing, and I've talked about that quite a lot. And
Ooh, I
about
love
also
that.
about yeah, about the table. Yeah, I've always been really struck with that. About the table fellowship in the end of Deathly Hallows. You know how McGonagall puts the house tables back, but nobody was sitting according to house anymore. And they're throwing food into Grop's mouth, and it's just this kind of lovely image of this table fellowship, which always struck me as having Eucharistic undertones. But then I went back because of the preponderance of food imagery in the Ichabod. So it got
Oh
me
yeah.
thinking.
Oh man, the Ichabod. You can't read that and be hungry at the same
Oh
time.
my, yeah, it's crazy. And then, with Rowling's slash Robert Galbraith's Cormoran Strike novels, there's also a lot of food in those books. They're always getting a Doom bar and a packet of crisps and, hashing out the case as it is, So all of this kind of made me say, well, I'm going to go back and look at book one a little bit. I actually ended up looking at books one, four, and seven, but I looked most closely at book one. You open that book and there are so many food images in the first like 100 pages of that book. It's conspicuous. And so as I looked at the way that the story was progressing, and he's moving from the Muggle world where he's really being denied food, and he's got kind of a food insecurity thing going on, and he enters into this magical world, and really probably the biggest thing, initially that you're cheering him on for is because he's got access to food now. Like he's got, and it's good food. And so she draws these associations between food and magic. So that all kind of made me think of not just the Eucharist, but also of alchemy. And there were a lot of connections between the Eucharist and alchemy in late medieval thought. They kind of hinge on some of the same sets of expectations for the transformation that's taking place in terms of, well, this is happening. It doesn't really match what we see and what we can experience with our senses, but there's this other ultimate reality going on underneath. And the ultimate aim of it is actually the transformation of the person into a better version of themselves. And so alchemy and Eucharist have a lot of those similar kind of themes. And you see so much alchemical imagery in Harry Potter, all this food imagery, and then there's kind of this overlap where things happen like Harry catches the Snitch in his first Quidditch match in his mouth, and has to spit it back out. Of course, we see that mirrored in the seventh book when he's carrying around this snitch that he caught in his first game. So we know that's significant for some for some reason. So I think in my paper, I really just started kind of teasing this stuff out. I think this could be a much bigger project, but I just kind of started teasing these things out, and it turned out, at least to me, to be very interesting. So
You know, I have to say, like, a lot of that, you know, you say it's conspicuous, all the food imagery in book one. But if you had just asked me, is there a lot of food imagery in the beginning part of the first book? I mean, I probably could have come up with some things, but probably not a lot. And then when you were explaining all of the things, it was like, oh, wow. I, you know, a lot of that I just hadn't noticed it. And I love it when, you know, when an idea like that makes you go back and look at the text and see things that you didn't see before. And so I think, Emily, I think we have to do a food episode.
I definitely think that there could be a lot to be said about food.
We'll do the dining hall. We'll do the
dining hall. Oh, I love the dining hall. I mean, if you think about it, food is this reality in our lives as humans that bridges the interior and the exterior. Mm-hmm. And Harry Potter is so much about learning to, you know, Harry over seven books, learning to identify with his interior life so that he has the strength and has the courage to give up his exterior life when he needs to, you know. And food is this thing that, you know, that golden snitch, he's carrying it around in book seven. It's just, I think it could be really fruitful. And if folks want to see that talk, that is up at my blog. It's liturgyandlife.com. So feel free to check it out. It's also on my YouTube channel, but it's there for you to check out and let me know what you think.
Neat. Yeah. And conference papers are great for the beginnings of ideas.
Yes.
I think. That's really, yes. And it's exciting because then you get a lot of good feedback.
Yeah, I did. And I had a lot of good comments, and I was excited. I was a little worried it was going to be like Catholic overload. I mean, I'm a Catholic scholar. I study Catholicism.
Well, and you filmed yourself in a church a few times in that presentation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. As soon as I heard it had to be pre-recorded, I was like, I need to film in prettier places than just my house.
But your house looks very nice too.
Oh, thank you. I was worried that people who aren't Catholic, who aren't interested in that sort of thing, were going to be like, meh. But it seemed like people were kind of excited about some of the connections. So it was great. It's just always great to be with people and share ideas.
Totally agree.
Now, Katie, one of the highlights of the conference for me that I have not mentioned yet came actually not during the conference, but it was when you shared your recorded talk on Arthur Weasley with me about Arthur Weasley and cultural appropriation. And I got to watch it actually before the conference, and then I got to go to a talk that was opposite yours that I wanted to go to. So that was, thank you.
That was me. Emily, tell me this isn't terrible.
We do a lot of that, folks. We do a lot of that. Okay. But your talk was really a great examination of Arthur Weasley just in and of itself. But even more valuably, it gave these helpful structures and these helpful articulations for thinking about and maybe even discerning kind of the relative value or harm of cultural appropriation itself. Rather than, you know, I get very frustrated sometimes with just the gut reactions that you hear in the media to a work that, you know, appropriates particular cultural aspects, whether they belong to the author or not. And so you often see these kind of gut reactions on either side of the culture wars, on the many sides of the culture wars with regard to cultural appropriation. But I thought yours was a really kind of level-headed way of looking at it through a beloved character, which kind of helped challenge, I think it helped challenge kind of both sides of that argument. So talk about what we can learn from Dear Mr. Weasley about cultural appropriation.
Yeah, so I got the idea for this paper when I was working on a paper that I am writing for an anthology about colonialism and the way that J.K. Rowling kind of uses historical rhetoric to do a kind of literary colonization through especially a lot of her Wizarding World histories, the ones that are in the J.K. Rowling archive. And I guess I was using Arthur Weasley as an example of somebody who is actually trying to bridge the divide between wizards and muggles. And our friend Lana Whited pointed out to me, she's like, I don't know. Like what's Arthur really doing there with the flying car? And it made me think about it a little bit deeper. And I thought, now that's actually really interesting because I think so often we take Arthur Weasley at face value. You know, he's a little bit funny, but we also really love him. Rowling says he's the only really good father figure in the series. And yet he does this thing that's really wrong in bewitching the car. It's illegal if it's going to be used. He wrote a law to have a loophole in it so that he would be able to do what he wanted, which was bewitch a muggle car. And it does raise the question of, is that cultural appropriation? And as I started to research it, I got all of these articles, you know, The Guardian, The Atlantic, and all of these things that were, you know, a little bit more like mainstream news sources. And it was like up at 11. Do you know what I mean? Like it went to 11. And I was like, I'm just, you know, everybody's got such a passion about what they're saying on either side. I would like to know analytically, what are we talking about with cultural appropriation? And so then I had to get a little bit more into the scholarship of cultural appropriation, which is relatively recent. It really starts in the 1970s. And it was started with the idea of calling it cultural colonialism. And then I sort of look at Arthur Weasley and say, like, is what he's doing really matching up with that? And one of the questions has been, you know, the thing is, cultures do not stay static and isolated. And that's we wouldn't want them to be. And if you look at, in
If
fact, a
they're
lot of
living
things that you
cultures.
consider to be like native to your culture, they are probably, you're getting a lot of them from cultural context with other people. That's just how cultures work. And so the question becomes not, you know, is it okay to borrow culturally? Because that's just how cultures work in a way. The question is harm created? Is their extreme offense, is something being stolen from people? Are people being misrepresented or insulted or stereotyped? And I found a really good definition that kind of breaks it down into here are the things. It's what they call a normative definition. It's sort of talking about this is what people really mean when they talk about cultural appropriation. And it breaks it down, and I sort of did a reading of whether Arthur is doing that. It's a sort of a, it's still kind of a maybe on him. He's not exactly doing the right thing with the car, but he's also not really creating harm to muggles. And one of the most interesting things that I was sort of struck by when I was writing this talk was cultural appropriation. It's usually a problem when you have a dominant group appropriating from a marginalized group. And when we're looking at the wizarding world, it's just not really clear to me which one is dominant and which one is marginalized. And I think that raises such an interesting question. The other sort of stumbling block for this study is that muggles don't know about wizard society. And so they can't be offended by the car because their memories are all modified. And it was just a problem in itself, of course. But this does, you know, it does lead to a different dynamic, I think, than what we are commonly talking about when we talk about cultural appropriation. So what I liked about it was, you know, to sort of take a little bit, like you said, take a little bit of the steam and the vitriol out of either side of the argument and just say, you know, what do we think? Is there harm being done? Is, you know, and when we look at a character who we like and we're gonna try to give the benefit of the doubt to, I think we can see some of the nuances of cultural appropriation that I think are maybe helpful when, because that conversation almost never has nuance when it's in the popular sphere.
Yeah, no, that was very refreshing. It was kind of challenging to see it from a lot of different perspectives. Because you're right, you know, the more you look at what he does with that car, the more the whole situation kind of stinks, kind of smells bad for Arthur Weasley. But at the same time, yeah, it was just a really helpful framework for being able to analyze it in a fruitful way that you could apply to other situations that may be much touchier, you know, maybe much more prone to offense. Than this fictional narrative and this beloved fictional character.
And the what I where I ended up with as I was thinking about it was I think Arthur might be doing something the scholar George Lipschitz calls strategic anti-essentialism, which is one of these phrases that is like not catchy, sort of hard to get your mind around it. But somebody who's practicing strategic anti-essentialism is, as a part of a powerful group, adopting some of the ways of a more marginalized group as a way to protest being part of that dominant or hegemonic culture. And I think, you know, the Weasleys are a pureblood family. They're part of the Sacred 28, although they don't agree with pureblood ideology. And of course, we know pureblood doesn't really mean anything. And so I think Arthur is actually doing something that is, he's rebelling against the anti-Muggle prejudices among so many pureblood wizards with his love of Muggles and his tinkering with the Muggle car. Right. And I think that it's not exactly the best way to go about it, but I think it helps to kind of understand that psychology a little more.
I mean, it's a good idea until your kids steal it.
Right.
Right. And then it's a bad idea.
It was okay when it was George and Fred. It's really Ron and Harry who mess things up. So, yeah.
Poor Ron. Yeah. Back to poor Ron.
So, Emily, what I love is I present on something different at the Harry Potter conference like every year. I get an idea and I get to go for it and give it a thought. And eventually these things sometimes develop into larger projects. And what I was really struck by at this particular conference was how much of the scholarship, and you could probably even hear it in some of the summaries that we were giving of some of the talks that people had, the Harry Potter scholarship is really reflecting general trends and waves in our country and in the world. And this conference was very, I think, politically engaged, just particularly this year. What did you think about the kind of political quality of so many of the conference presentations this year? What do you think that's saying about Potter studies, Potter scholarship in general?
Well, it's certainly a snapshot in time. I mean, I went and voted early on Friday, and the lines and lines and lines of people, it was quite startling to me. And I thought, wow, there's a lot more people who are politically engaged right now than maybe there usually are, at least where I live. So, you know, I'm struck. I mean, even my 9-year-old has a lot of political opinions, you know. So in that sense, it's a snapshot of the times because, you know, this is a lot of what we're paying attention to.
Right.
And this may be partly because we're cooped up and we don't have our usual, you know, activities to enjoy.
There's not a lot of ignoring politics that's possible right now.
Right. Yeah. The sand that you could stick your head in before seems to have blown away. So, and if you think about it, you know, it's an interesting time for scholarship in general in that it seems to me that it's increasingly acceptable to do scholarship on contemporary works. In terms of Potter scholarship, I mean, these are works that are reflections of, even though they're 20 years old now, they're still reflections on our contemporary times. Because, I mean, you know, you can say that the times we're living in now are, I mean, you know, they're related to things that happened just previously. And so I think that in that sense, it makes sense that the scholarship is political because the works, you know, have a lot of political implications. And in a time like that we're living in now, that's really, really amplified.
Right. And I've always thought the Potter series was quite political, and that's where a lot of my interest in it lies. I'm very interested in the political qualities as well as the literary, but I tend to veer more toward the political. And I was thinking about when you were talking in the chat while Timothy Snyder was giving his talk, there was a sort of question about how did she predict that this was going to be so relevant? And it's really that these are long-term trends.
Yes.
This is not something that just popped up. It's something that has been building, and people who have been paying attention, they can kind of see it on the horizon for decades. Mm-hmm. And the Harry Potter books really are a part of that visioning, and they were able to even like predictively articulate some of the political trends that exist in the world now, and that's why they seem very relevant to us in our particular moment.
Right. And we keep talking about them, we keep finding new angles, and you're right, it does seem predictive, but This is something that Star Wars fans can really appreciate, because George Lucas always said history is like poetry. It rhymes, or it kind of repeat. It's too simple to say it repeats itself, but it's sort of it's cyclical in a sense. And so I think that we see some of that with the politics of Harry Potter as well. But one of the great things about it is it becomes the literature that we study becomes a safer space to talk about some of these political realities than the actual political arena in which we may be at loggerheads with one another. But, you know, if we're both readers of Harry Potter, we can come to the table and talk together about tyranny or bureaucracy or, you know, whatever, in a little bit more of a safe zone. And I think that that's one of the great values of it, not just literarily, but obviously politically, and helping people to think more broadly about political realities.
Yeah, and one of the points that I had made in my Dumbledore's Army and the White Rose paper, which is about comparing Dumbledore's Army to the students in the White Rose Society during Nazi-ruled Germany, during the war, actually, who spoke out against the Nazis, and sort of comparing them to Dumbledore's Army. I said in that J.K. Rowling is very aware that these kinds of problems repeat in successive generations. And that's really what we're witnessing in Harry Potter's realm, right? Because this is an evil that existed in his own parents' time. And we know in the Fantastic Beasts, we're actually seeing, you know, an earlier generation dealing with a different version of it coming from Grindelwald, but same basic idea. And that she sees it as something that repeats. And her sense of history is, I think, really strong. Mm-hmm. And she understands that the students have to know some of the history, you know, the Harry Potter kids, they have to figure out history along the way. And it calls us to be mindful of our own history as well. As a historian, I just obviously really value that.
Yeah, it is. It is refreshing.
Yeah. So I'm very excited to see where Harry Potter scholarship is going. And I'm hoping that our podcast here at Potterversity, we are going to be trying to bring you listeners the latest and the greatest of Harry Potter scholarship so that you can feel like you are right in the center, the cutting edge of Potter studies education.
Yes, maybe this would be a good time to invite you in a special way to send us your thoughts, your ideas, the scholarship that you're working on. We'd like, in this new iteration of this podcast, we'd like to get more voices at the table. We'd like to hear from new scholars, scholars who maybe haven't published yet, but are really hoping to, and who would like to be on the show and talk about their work. So we'd love it if you would write us in, and we'll tell you more about how to contact us at the end of the show.
That's a great plug. Now, we also have brought together some folks who were at the Harry Potter Academic Conference to talk about their experiences, the highlights of the conference for them. And listeners, we are now going to go over to the Potterversity staff room to listen in on a little bit of what they had to say.
Overheard in the Potterversity staff room.
That's great. I hope you can.
Hi, Tim. How are you?
I brought up your paper too when I saw, well, I watched your recording later because I couldn't make yours live. So I just watched it earlier today. And I wouldn't have thought to connect your paper to that when we were just talking about necessarily, except that, you know, you're talking about like the Eucharist and all these very, like, again, like, these very high religious sort of symbolic themes. I wouldn't necessarily have connected that to something as sort of realistic and, you know, sort of mundane, I guess, is like, you know, your living experience. But then you were using the term food scarcity in terms of the Eucharist and like fasting and what it means to go without food. And that, like, that word means something to me this year in a way that it never had before, in terms of the pandemic and the poverty that we're seeing and everything. So it just was like an interesting resonance that I think a year ago, if you had said food scarcity, it wouldn't have hit me in the same way that it did in the context of 2020.
Yeah, and I probably am influenced by that too, because we've had people, Catholics who are very devout, would be attending Mass daily and weekly, who have not even had the Eucharist, who have not even been able to share in the Eucharist for months. I teach a course on it, a virtual course, and these are people who are like so dedicated to the Eucharist that they take classes on it in their spare time. And they haven't been since March because it's not safe and they have pre-existing conditions. And so I think that that was probably part of my thinking there, is this idea of these very, you know, people who, for whom this means a ton, and they're even not able to partake of it. It's tough.
Yeah, it's hard.
Many thanks to Catherine Sass for joining us in the Potterversity staff room. That brings us to the end of our episode today. Emily, it was so great to chat with you.
And also with you. I had a great time.
Yeah. I hope that some of our listeners might join us next year at the Harry Potter Academic Conference at Chestnut Hill.
Their website is harrypotterconference.com. What could be easier?
Right. And stay tuned for their announcements about paper submissions, which usually happens in the summertime. Mm-hmm. And they might actually keep some virtual elements. We'll have to see. But hopefully we will be able to be back in person again by that point. Well, listeners, we hope that you have enjoyed this episode. Always remember that at Potterversity, as Headmaster Albus Dumbledore said, differences of habit and language are nothing at all if our aims are identical and our hearts are open.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes, and be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckhoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsburn, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsburn. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
See you next time. Class dismissed.